And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Here at Quark's, customer satisfaction is our primary concern.
I'd say we just found our way into a wormhole.
I'm Kira Nerys.
Lieutenant Commander Worf, reporting for duty, sir.
You're the best crew any captain ever had. This may be the last time we're all together.
This will shortly become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. For Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
It is quite simply, Commander. The journey you have always been destined to take.
Sensors are not functioning.
We've lost all contact with the space station.
What the hell is happening out there?
Shields up. Damage report.
Battle stations.
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Listen to the prophets. A Deep Space Nine Two True Freaks presentation with Sean Engel and Andrew Layla.
And now with 100% more Paul Spataro.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the greatest Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast on the internet. Listen to the prophets, hosted by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. Know how I carefully worded that last sentence so it could be both truthful and hyperbole at the same time. Yeah, this is episode number 22, and as we've been doing for the past few months, we're going through every episode of Deep Space Nine and giving you, our wonderful listeners, our scintillating commentary, insight, and opinions. Or at least what isn't stolen from Memory Alpha or the Star Trek Deep Space Nine companion. And this time out, we're finishing up the third part of the Circle Trilogy with the Season 2 episode, The Siege. And joining me, as always, to offer up their figurative two strips of gold-pressed latinum are my good friends, Mr. Andrew Leyland. Hello, Andy.
Hello, Sean and Paul.
And, of course, Mr. Paul Spataro. Hey, Paul.
Hola.
So how have you guys been? Like, we haven't been talking for the past, 30 minutes.
We've been tickety-boo. How about you?
Oh, I've been doing good. I'm looking forward to talking about some Star Trek this time out.
Yeah, I'm doing good also, and I don't know, we did this 2 weeks ago, but it feels like so much longer.
Yeah, it's always good getting together with you guys and just chatting about stuff, and there, of course, like most of the shows, there's a lot of pre-show stuff that you'll never hear about, but
luckily
yes, because it would just get us in trouble. But
that's where we get all the swearing out the way.
Thank God.
That.
Oh. Okay, 28:36. Make an edit there because Paul cannot be trusted to be clean on the show. Okay. Do we have any Star Trek news before we get into the synopsis or anything?
Sadly, I think nothing.
It's all been quiet on the Western Front, hasn't it?
Yeah, the only thing that I really saw, and again, unfortunately, all the Star Trek news is about the upcoming new Star Trek 3 movie. The only thing that I saw, and this might be of interest, is Idris Elba, who played Heimdall in the Thor movies and was also Luthor on the TV show in the UK.
Mr. Luthor.
Yeah, well, he wasn't Mr. Luthor, but I guess he could have been. He's supposedly up for a role in the third Star Trek movie as a villain, and everyone's speculating what kind of villain he could be.
I'm thinking Klingon.
It wouldn't be surprising if he were a Klingon. I wouldn't know if he'd be a specific Klingon or if whether he'd just be some new unnamed Klingon, but I wouldn't have a problem with Idris Elba being in the movie. I've enjoyed everything that he's been. I liked Pacific Rim. I thought he was great in that. He didn't really have much to do as Heimdall in the Thor movies, but he was good. He's an imposing character. Did you ever watch Luthor? Or Luthor?
I have not seen Luthor.
Have you ever watched Mr. Luthor? Luthor.
It's a little bitty show.
Miss Tischbecker has her own show. I've never watched Luthor.
The Luthor.
Idris Elba's a brilliant actor, and I like Idris Elba a great deal, so I have no problem with him being in Star Trek 3.
Yeah, I thought, considering he had such a small part, I thought he really kind of dominated the screen when he was on it in Thor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that speaks a lot for him as an actor and as a character, because, again, he did have a very small part.
That's not what she said. Oh, sorry, that was horrible.
But I think it would be a mistake to make him a known Klingon at this point. It's time to move on to new ground.
Mm-hmm.
But let's not make him, you know, one of the. There's only a handful of famous Klingons from the first series, anyway.
Yeah, there's Kang, there's Koloth, and then there's the wishy-washy one from Tribbles.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have Krug from
3,
Search for Spock.
Yeah.
So I mean, you're really talking 4 significant Klingons. We can add a 5th.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be Kang. Well, unless they do the Abrams route of calling him something else through production, and then it being a big reveal that he's Kang in the film, because that's a main plot point, but we've hid it from everyone for no readily apparent reason, despite the fact we all knew that that's who was playing in the first place.
You're not bitter about that, are you, Andy?
I'm not bitter about it, no. I just think it was pointless.
And, well, the nice thing is that Kang is so, so different of a name than Khan.
Yeah.
There would be no comparisons at all.
No.
Don't blame me. I voted for Kodor.
I wanted Kodos.
Well.
Is it Kodor? I'm thinking that. Yes. I'm mixing up my Game of Thrones.
Hodor. Yeah, you're thinking Hodor. Yeah, Kodos.
Hodor!
See, after we finish up, you know, after we finish up Deep Space Nine, we've got Firefly, then we've got Game of Thrones. Hopefully, by the time we finish up Deep Space Nine, Game of Thrones will be finished. If not, hopefully, George R. R. Martin will finish it by then.
Oh, you just planted a seed in my mind that you didn't want to put there, because now no. I'm thinking, oh yeah, we could do Game of Thrones. I love Game of Thrones. So.
I love Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love it more.
Oh, okay, you win.
I'm still, unfortunately, I'm not subscribing to HBO, so I've got to find it. You know, I'm waiting for the Blu-rays or the DVDs come out, so I just watched season 3, and I think season 4 on Blu-ray is coming out, so I'm like a season behind. So I've got to figure out, I was lucky enough to not see the episode, the Red Wedding episode. You know, I'd heard all about it, but when I finally saw it, that was impressive. And if you are a Game of Thrones fan and you haven't seen it, I'm not spoiling it, but oh wow. they did it. So, but this isn't a Game of Thrones podcast.
But it might be after Firefly.
Not yet.
But yeah, we need to talk about Deep Space Nine. So let's go ahead and get into that, okay?
The Bajorans are taking back the station.
I wouldn't blame anyone for getting out now while you can.
Come with us.
We can't just let the Cardis have the wormhole.
Sisko and the crew prepare for the final battle.
How can you sit and wait for them to attack?
Dead is a martyr. Alive, he seals our victory.
Now, a dangerous mission may be the last hope.
We'll never outrun them in this.
Right, just point at them and fire.
In preventing an all-out war on the next episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
All right.
That works for me.
Okay. We're looking at The Siege, which was the 23rd episode of Deep Space Nine here, and it aired in the United States on or about the 10th of October of 1993. This one was written by Michael Piller and directed by Wenrick Kolb, and starred the main cast, as well as Philip Anglim as Vedic Bryle, Louise Fletcher as Vedic Wynn, Richard Boehmer as Lee Nalis, Stephen Mocht as General Krim, Frank Langella as Minister Jaro, and Stephen Weber as Colonel Day. And as usual, the synopsis comes from the Star Trek Deep Space Nine Companion by Terry J. Erdman and Paula M. Block. With less than 5 hours remaining before Bajoran forces are due to arrive, Sisko evacuates Deep Space Nine of civilians and non-essential personnel. However, he is elected to remain behind to delay the station takeover and is pleased when his offers and Lee Nalis choose to stay with him. Since all communications to Bajor are still jammed, Kira reasons that someone will have to go to the Chamber of Ministers to reveal the Cardassians' involvement at the Circle. With the runabouts tied up transporting evacuees, Kira and Dax arrange a ride to Bajor's Lunar 5 base, where several old sub-impulse vessels have been hidden since the Cardassian occupation. When the Bajoran troops, led by Colonel Day and Over-General Krim, arrive at the station, it appears to be deserted, although Krim knows that appearances can be deceiving. He notes that the station's internal security net has been sabotaged, effectively preventing them from tracking the movements of anyone on board. which could mean that Starfleet has left a contingent behind. While Day and Krim argue about strategy, Sisko and his hidden teams prepare their own strategy, and soon capture a small search party of Bajoran soldiers. On Lunar 5, Kira and Dax manage to get a dilapidated raider up and running, but their signal is intercepted by two more powerful Bajoran vessels. Kira takes her vessel into Bajor's atmosphere, hoping to outmaneuver the bigger ships, but the raider is disabled and the women are forced to make a crash landing on the planet's surface. Sisko lures Day into a holosuite, where the Bajoran finds himself trying to disarm holographic images. Sisko quickly seals the holosuite door and speaks to Day over the comms system, briefing him on the Cardassian plot. But Day doesn't believe it, and after Sisko releases him, he declines to pass Sisko's information on to Krim. Instead, he and Krim intensify the search for Sisko. Knowing that they may not have much time left before the Bajorans find them, Sisko appeals to a frightened Lee Nalis, asking him to be the man his people think he is. A short time later, Bashir creates a diversion, drawing away Day and providing O'Brien, Lee, and Sisko with access to Krim. On Bajor, Kira and Dax have survived the crash, but Kira is badly wounded, and the two are quickly discovered, fortunately for them, by Bajorans from Barile's monastery. Barile helps to disguise them in religious garb, and they head for the Chamber of Ministers. Interrupting the gather of legislators, Kira finds herself in the midst of a chaotic scene, very similar to the orb vision that she experienced days earlier. Although Jaro immediately attempts to have her arrested, Kira realizes that this will be her only opportunity to make the ministers listen. She hastily presents her evidence of the Cardassian plot that Jaro unwittingly helped to facilitate, and Vedic Wynn, knowing that Jaro is finished, sides with Kira and the other ministers against her former ally. On the station, Krim confronts Day about neglecting to brief him about Sisko's comments. Day protests that Sisko's words were lies, but Krim has received information from Bajor. Noting that Bajor's provisional government has prevailed, Krim prepares to return command of Deep Space Nine back to Starfleet. But Day refuses to accept the turnabout. Pulling out his phaser, he fires at Sisko, but Lee, reacting quickly, leaps into the path of the beam. Mortally wounded, Lee expresses relief that he is, quote-unquote, off the hook at last. But Sisko knows that Lee will always be remembered by his people as a hero, a role that, sadly, was more comfortable for him in death than in life. And what do we think about this one, gentlemen?
I guess I'll go first. I really like this. I thought this was, like I said, it feels like longer ago since we did the last two episodes than it actually is. So I'm trying to remember. I know we liked them, but I'm trying to remember exactly how we termed it. And I seem to remember, at least my opinion was, that it was kind of a slow ramp up, knowing that it was a three-part episode and that it was building up the tension, but not overly action filled. And I kind of feel like this was the return on it. This gave us, this delivered on what built up on the first two episodes. And it was a nice conclusion to it. It was satisfying. There was, some actual things that occurred. I have, some individual notes, but I guess we'll get to those later. But overall, I thought this was a pretty solid episode and as I said, a pretty satisfying one. So I'm giving it a thumbs up, and we'll talk a little bit more in detail as we go on.
I think it's a solid conclusion to the three-part story. I think that the budget restraints hurt it a little bit. I think there were places where it was very insular, where it should have been a bit more expansive. Kira and Dax being pursued on the runabout being a prime example. We never left the interior of the ship. I do feel that we returned to the, say it with me, status quo a little bit too easy at the end of the episode. I don't think Deep Space Nine's quite got that thing yet, which it will get as we go along, that events have consequences and cause changes that stay changed. And I think this episode was a bit too quick to revert everything back to what it was before the three-parter. But on the whole, very, very enjoyable. And Dax was incredibly hot as a Vedic.
So who would think she'd be hotter by putting on more clothing?
Yeah, who would think that in that? Who would have thought that in that outfit that she'd be what she was?
It's the addition of the nose ridges that makes her incredible.
Is that what it was?
Yeah, sure.
Well, yeah, you know what? She's cute enough to begin with. You start giving a little nose ridge, and if you get it, you're all over it.
You just want to know where that nose ridge goes. I have to agree with you guys. I really enjoyed it. I think they say in the companion, the first episode of this trilogy was more like The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, while this episode was more like The Alamo. It was a siege mentality. It's the Bajorans against the Federation, and the Federation trying to subvert everything to make sure that Kira and Dax can get to the ministers to give their information about the Cardassian plot to try and get weapons to the Circle. I actually, despite the fact that all the scenes in the little shuttle with Kira and Dax were all filmed from the interior, I thought they did pretty good amount of special effects and a pretty good amount of physical acting in that, because I actually felt like they were trying to maneuver around in that ship. You know, when they did those sharp turns, you know, they were leaning back and pushing forward and everything. So I thought the physical effects in there were rather good. I liked the characters. I thought there was some great character interaction between not only one of the big scenes I liked was at the beginning. There was a little scene between Jake and Nog where they're saying goodbye. I think there was a bunch of, you know, and going back to Kira and Dax, I thought this was perhaps like the best camaraderie that these two characters have had in the show. So I thought this was a show that had, you know, action in it. Yes, the effects weren't as spectacular as we've seen in other episodes, but I think all the character moments in this actually propelled this to a higher level of episode than others have been.
Now, my biggest criticism of the episode, get that off the table first, is I thought Steven Weber was miscast as Colonel Day. I don't know, getting a comic actor from Wings just didn't really sit correctly as far as I was concerned. I never found him believable in the role, and it wasn't just that I'm looking at him and I'm seeing, the ne'er-do-well from Wings. It was more that just he doesn't have the weight to his performance to accept him as the heavy the way he was being presented in the show. He just never seemed natural delivering his lines, and I really think the show would have been better off having somebody just slightly more menacing.
I think the problem with him as well is he wasn't developed very well, and his betrayal, for want of a better word, never came as a surprise. Despite having three episodes to tell this story, I think they floundered on his character, and maybe having him in it a bit more, or maybe developing a bit more, showing where his allegiances were, maybe that would have helped as well. So yeah, he just came across as a very two-dimensional bad guy.
And I'm not into the performances from the mustache twirling villain, but I think because he had less screen time, maybe he needed to be more mustache twirling just to get his character across a little better.
Yeah, I think if they would have developed him in the second episode, they would have seen him working with the Stephen Mocked character as Krim. I think that would have, you know, given a little bit more emphasis as his of him being the sort of lackey to the provisional government or trying to be in league with Charo. So, but yeah, I can see what you're saying, Paul. He really didn't have all that much of a character arc in this.
They didn't do as good a job with him as they did with Frank Langella.
But they also, I also thought that he had just as little screen time, but that Stephen Mocked as General Krim was good in the role. I enjoyed his portrayal, and
he had more shades to him, though. And again, I don't know if this is the actor or the writing, but he brought more to it. You got the distinct impression from the beginning this was a guy who was doing what he thought was the right thing, even though he was on, from our point of view, the wrong side. But he didn't have the information that we had. And you kind of knew that the minute he had that information, he would switch sides, which is why Steven Weber's character didn't give it to him. I would have liked to have seen that Weber's character of Day knew that Mac's character would do that, and that's why he withheld. As it was in the show, he just didn't tell him, and then later on he palms him off with some excuse that, oh, they were lying. But you don't not give your commanding officer pertinent information.
Yeah, but I agree totally with all of that. I just, the silly thought I had was that I would cast Stephen Mock as Nathaniel Richards if I was doing a Fantastic Four movie. Because I see him as an older Reed Richards.
Yeah, and like you say, he had more to him. And the minute that he comes into the possession of the information that we have, that Jarrow's working inadvertently with the Cardassians, he switches sides.
And I'm sorry, I keep interrupting. I apologize.
No, it's fine. That was ending there anyway, so that's fine.
You could see like how he, you know, how his character, he wasn't the bumbling general either. He was clearly using the information. He knew what, you know, he was analyzing it, and for the most part correctly what he had. And I like when they first came on the ship, and you know, he immediately suspected that something was going on, and it just, to me, it was reminiscent of them coming on the ship and hearing the countdown in The Search for Spock.
Yeah.
Only he wasn't an idiot like the Klingons who came aboard.
Well, the station is speaking to us.
It's the only thing speaking. Put it on.
What Mission Log podcaster said, so the Klingons don't have talking computers, do they not?
Guess not. Yeah, I have to admit, and I think because Stephen Mocht had that interaction with Sisko in the second episode, that he had a sort of respect for Sisko and the Federation. He knew that this wasn't going to be just an easy takeover of the station, that they would put up the defense. And it was, you know, Krim, the character, knew that it would be... You had two people who were on opposite sides, but they were both knowledgeable combatants, and they both had respect for each other. And I think the respect that was set forth in the second episode carried over to this one and allowed the character of Krim and Sisko to work well against each other. But yeah, I agree with what you're saying, that Steven Weber's character was just, you know, it didn't feel Vapid. Right. Well, Vapid's a good one, yeah. One of the things that I thought was kind of amusing, and I don't know if you noticed this, but I guess the 31st rule of acquisition for the Ferengi is no yo mama jokes. I just that just cracked me up that you know, as Quark is coming out of little Jeffrey's tube or whatever, carrying his suitcase full of gold pressed latinum, you know, he says it's, you know, heirlooms and memories of my family, and Bashir basically goes, oh, I know it's not that because your mama told me. I was like, oh, snap, he did not do that.
Girlfriend.
I was like, really? And it kind of flies in the face of what we'll find out later about how the Ferengis view women, because if that's the case, if the rule of acquisition is don't make fun of your mother, why do you have your mother standing around, you know, naked, you know, being subservient to the man all the time, if you're so respectful of her?
You don't make fun of the Negus's girlfriend that way.
That's true.
But, yeah, I mean, it doesn't mean, if society doesn't respect him, it doesn't mean that their children don't.
Oh, well, there you go. That's a good enough no prize.
I'll run with that.
We will accept that.
Although, I mean, anybody...
Sisko's good in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
He has a brilliant speech at the beginning that reminded me of one of my favourite films, and I think it's one of Paul's as well. There's an outlaw Josie Wales element to his speech at the beginning, that governments make decisions that affect people. And we've been working with the Bajorans for many, many years now, and his best friend's a Bajoran, and he's going out with a Bajoran, and we can't just split up those allegiances easy. And it very much reminded me of Josie going to deal with the Native Americans at the end of Josie Wales, and saying, governments don't live with people, people live with people. And
I thought that was
a really interesting parallel, that just because your government now says this guy's the enemy, if you've got a relationship with somebody of that specific nationality, that's the word I'm looking for, your relationship with that person on an individual level doesn't stop just because your governments have split apart. And I thought that was really interesting exploration of the Star Trek philosophy of IDIC, infinite diversity and infinite combinations. And he does it without it being a stand-up speech moment. Because I actually don't think there's anyone in Star Trek who can deliver them as well as William Shatner can.
I thought it reminded me of Picard's speech from Insurrection.
Yeah. Or First Contact as well. The line is drawn here.
Well, that speech, though, is more just a one-on-one conversation that he wigs out on. The Insurrection one is, you know, to the crew, basically, as he's getting ready to leave on his own, and then they all come over to him and they say, no, you're not leaving without us.
No uniforms.
Yeah,
that's wearing uniforms. Yeah. I liked that bit. I liked Sisko very much in this episode.
I like Sisko in almost every episode. I don't think we've seen him in an episode where we could say he was bad yet.
We've seen some times when he's speechifying, like earlier on in the first season, that one speech that he gave was just very sort of trite, you know. It was very pat, you know, we all need to get together and you need to not persecute this man. It was very, you know, but when he's got good writing behind him, I think, you know, he can really do no wrong. God, I'm trying to think anything else.
Well, I got a couple of other little notes in here. I liked, and I think we talked about this in the last two episodes also, I liked Richard Boehmer as Lee Nallis, and I thought he made a good short-term addition to the cast. I thought he fit in really well. I thought he played the role really well. But I also felt very satisfied that his story arc had concluded, and although his character was likable, there's no reason to, like, have a problem that he's no longer with us. He had a good story arc, and it was completed. So I liked that a lot.
See, I felt that played into me the series bringing it all back to where it wanted it to be. I think I would have liked him to survive, simply because he didn't want to.
Yeah, but I'm just not sure where you would go with him anyway at this point. His story arc had concluded.
I think a lot of it is me bringing what the show will become into these early episodes. Later on, they won't be as pat with how they resolve storylines. And it just felt to me that killing him off at this point was the safe, predictable thing to do. And later on, the show won't do the safe, predictable thing. I think that was my main problem. For this story arc, you are absolutely right. His story is finished. Bump him off. Move on to the next episode. And I think there's a certain amount of baggage that I'm bringing with it that I know as we get into seasons 4, 5, 6, etc., they wouldn't do something that predictable.
Mm. All right, yeah. I can go with you on that. I like the interplay between Odo and Quark.
Always fun.
In particular, I also, you know, I liked the interplay between them, and I also liked Quark's moments after that where Rom sold his ticket. The only thing that was missing there was him actually looking, you know, proud of Rom for doing it or something along those lines.
Yeah, because he didn't hold it against him, did he? Which was a nice touch.
Well, he was still lugging around all that gold-pressed latinum, so he was still fine with it. And
he was willing to give it up to get a seat, though, at that point. He realized his life was in serious danger.
Well, but only 20 bars. I'm certain he had, you know, triple that, at least. One of the things he said was Rom went off with a Dabo girl. Are we thinking that's Chase Masterson's character?
Lita,
yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that was my thought. That I'm thinking that we're going to eventually find out that that's who that was.
Yeah, and
I don't remember if they call back to the moment at all.
I don't think we've seen Chase in any of the shows yet. So she hadn't been, you know, introduced yet. But I will say, Morn made it back in the show, and he was there for a pretty big scene. So it wasn't hard catching Morn in this episode. So we do have.
No, he's on the evacuation ship, isn't mm-hmm. he?
Yeah, he was.
Return to greatness.
Yes. So, yes. Thank.
Return to greatness.
We can always feel comfortable now that Morn is back in the show.
Yes. I love Kira and Dax's scenes because they were sparking off each other in a really interesting way. Kira was gleeful at the opportunity to be flagrantly disobeying orders, but this time for the right reasons. And her and Dax sparking off each other was really good, especially because the actors played it that even though they like each other and they get on with each other, in such a confined space, they were getting on each other's nerves.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked that. I thought that was really truthfully played.
I like that they finally played on the fact that Dax has all these previous lives and previous memories and previous skills, and that they were able to play that up in Dax being able to use some of the knowledge of one of her previous hosts to make sure that she could get the engines running on this little, you know, essentially Ford Pinto of a spaceship to get it going.
Just don't hit it from behind.
Yeah, if it gets rammed from behind, it blows up.
What else do I have here? The scene with the holodeck reminded me of the scene in Unification when Data sets up my mind is not here. Data sets up the image of them to be arrested, and kind of Riker has his hair messed up in it. Anything that's sparking any memory in you guys, or am I just?
It's been so long since I've watched that.
He sets up a hologram of himself, Spock, and Riker. So when they burst in, they're arresting holograms. Meanwhile, the real people are off doing something else, which is very similar to what they did here.
Mm. It sounds like Superman 2 to me.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's the same thing again. I didn't even think of that. That's for slightly more comical purposes. Mr. Leland.
Thankfully, no one pulled out a giant cellophane S and wrapped someone up in it, because that would have been just egregious.
Too much.
Yeah. It's mildly inconvenient.
No, I really don't have anything. I enjoyed this episode. I really don't have anything else to talk about. I think we covered pretty much all my notes.
Well, we've not covered the ending. Were Louise, I was going to say Louise Jameson, she was in Doctor Who, wasn't she? Where Louise, what's her name? Vedic Wynn.
Yeah, Fletcher. Louise Fletcher, yeah.
Turns on Jarrow.
Oh, I love that.
Absolutely brilliant moment, really setting up where she's going to go in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I my note is just Louise Fletcher, great as always.
Mm-hmm. She's brilliant, she's manipulative, she knows how to play. She knows which way the wind is blowing, and she goes with that because she's an opportunist. She will do anything to get her own way. She would have sided with Jaro when things were going his way, but now that things are looking bad for him, oh, well, let's see if this investigation does turn out that you've been, you know, siding with the Cardassians. Yes, let's look into that. And it's the political machinations and the sort of underheadedness of all of this are just great. This is something that you don't see all that much in Star Trek series, and the fact that we're getting in this series, it's just another added bonus that makes the show so much more entertaining.
Mm. And it's really setting her up for the future as well, because we'll never see Jaro again, which is a shame.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, my note on him is that Frank Langella is just kind of dripping with like evil oil, you know, just that politician evil throughout. So between him and Louise Fletcher, I think they just feed off each other, and they played wonderfully together.
Well, and I love
and
how
it does it sets up her relationship later on with Dukat.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, clearly she's not above, you know, getting into bed with anyone who's going to further her purposes.
No, she's not above selling out her people for her own gains, for power. And we're seeing very slowly here her taking her steps to doing that. Because at this juncture, they're working with the Cardassians, but they don't know it. Later on, she will openly work with the Cardassians. And she's not in this one very much, but it lays an awful lot of groundwork for where we're going to take her later, which I think is one of the things that's really good about this one. And also the crew don't even know that she's a threat yet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Sisko knows.
Yeah, he doesn't trust her from the beginning, but you get the distinct impression Sisko doesn't trust politicians.
But like you say, I think the people in general don't realize yet, because there is something about her that's authoritative, and you start thinking, well, she knows what she's talking about, and kind of accepted. She's like I think I said last time, that she outperforms her Oscar-winning One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest performance on DS9 on a regular basis, and she deserved the Oscar for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Mm.
Yeah, she's absolutely brilliant in this show.
Once again, the difference between doing a movie and doing a TV show, you have so much more time to flesh out the character on DS9 than they did to just do the two plus hours of Nurse Ratched. So you get to develop the sort of scheming nature of this character more than you could have with Nurse Ratched. So, but yeah, she's wonderful. So are we good? Do we want to give?
Yeah, I mean, the only other thing I want to say, I think O'Brien should have evacuated the station with his family. I think it would have been nice after Sisko's speech at the beginning to actually have one member of the opening credit cast say, look, I'm not going to stay. I've set everything up so it runs for you, but I'm going to leave with my family, and have Sisko hold no grudge against him for doing that, because that's the whole point of his speech at the beginning. So I do think I would have preferred, because he doesn't really do anything. And I think it would have been nice just once to have that scene where the commanding officer says, you know, people can go and there will be no reprisals, and actually have somebody go.
Somebody that isn't on board with my little scheme of marching around the square.
Yeah. Just somebody actually just leave.
Is my reference lost there?
Was that... Go on.
It's Monty Python's Meaning of Life.
Oh, yes, of course. You made a Python reference that we didn't get. That men of a certain age didn't get.
Is anyone else who's not on board with my scheme of marching around the square? Well, I was going to go out with the wife and kids. All right, off with you then.
Well, yeah, O'Brien could have even had that line. And I'd have been down with that. Because I did actually think, even though Keiko's a bit whiny, she did have a point.
My thought would have been that O'Brien as a character would have felt obligated to stay regardless. You know, I know it would have worked better if he would have went with his wife, because it's my family, I need to go with them, and having dedication to family. But I think, unfortunately, they're writing the O'Brien character as Starfleet first, family man second, which I don't know how that works. I mean, that's just too sort of pat. You know, you think of all these Starfleet characters as thinking of Starfleet first. It would be nice to see, you know, a person go, this is my family. They could all die. You know, if I could die, and what would that, how would that affect my family? So if they would have gone that route.
It's a different matter if this is, he's under orders to do this and he has to stay. I'm perfectly down with him saying, look, Keiko, I can't come with you. I'm a Starfleet officer. This is my duty. But Sisko's just basically said to him, you know, if you've got families, we're evacuating them, and you can go, and I will have no problem with that. And I honestly think a family man O'Brien would have been torn a bit more than he was depicted in this episode. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't disagree with you. He probably would have stayed. But at the same time, just once, it would be nice to have somebody take the commander up on his offer of there being no reprisals if he goes with his family.
Yeah. Oh, I can go? Well, okay, bye.
I prefer only to go against what the commander wants when it's in open defiance of his statements.
Like O'Brien did with Tosk.
Yes.
Okay, so do we want to give this some ratings?
You're
first.
Yeah,
sure.
Okay, I will go ahead and go first. Like I said, I really enjoyed this. I think I may have even enjoyed this a little better than the first two episodes, which I gave 3.5 for both those. I'm going to go ahead and give this a 4. This was a good conclusion to a trilogy of really good opening episodes. Some nice character moments. I think, like I said, Dax and Kira were really great. Sisko was exceptional as before. As always, Odo and Quark are good. And even a really nice scene between Jake and Nog. You know, the characters that have been sort of, you know, secondary in the cast. Good character moments, good politics, good development of the sort of evil characters on the show. Yeah, 4 bars of gold pressed platinum.
Can I just say, I don't think we will ever hear the phrase good politics anywhere else. Yeah, I mean, other than I think it was wrapped up too pat, I think it's a 4 as well. I mean, if you have a look in the companion, they do say that the killing off of Leen Alice was because they didn't think they could afford Richard Boehmer on a regular basis. So some of it was budgetary, and I do think the budgetary strings show quite a lot in this episode, but in all the bits that count, character, plot, acting, it's a top draw show. 4.
Yeah, well, we're going to be across the board then, because I'm a 4 on it as well. As I said, I think it's a fine conclusion to a 3-part episode. You don't see much in the way of 3-part episodes in Star Trek. But I think
it's the first time they've done it, isn't it?
As far as I know, yeah.
Yeah, they've been 2-parters, you know, in Next Gen, You know, and obviously,
and Enterprise will do a three-parter, won't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes, it does. But I think they pulled it off well. I think they did a good job of bringing it along and like I said, building up the suspense that when you finally got to a somewhat more action-heavy episode, that it paid off. It felt like they earned it, and it's not the bombastic multiple part episode that, you know, best of both worlds was or anything like that, but it's a very satisfying show to watch or episode to watch. And I think, unfortunately for me, I think it probably would have even been better served to sit and watch all three consecutively, but I did it separately because time constraints required me to do that. But I still really enjoyed it. So 4.0, very solid episode.
Huh. You know, I want to say something kind of surprising. So far, Paul, now this is just three episodes into the second season, you have the highest ranking of all of us, which was...
I am very rank.
which was completely antithetical.
That shouldn't be surprising at all.
I mean, last time out, I think you were, you know, we were all sort of in line, but I think you had the lowest overall ranking of the shows, but...
Yeah. Well, so far, three episodes in, we are... ranking is identical, with the exception of the fact that I was half a point higher than you guys on the homecoming.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the whole basis.
That's
for
the
my
thing that knocks you up above the rest of us. So there you go. Well, I think we've got a couple of emails. Do we want to go ahead and get those read?
Incoming transmission.
Yeah. Okay, we've got a couple from Gene and then one from Tim Elliott. Do you want to just do the one?
Why don't we do two in this and two in the next?
Okay. Well, the one from Doris Liang isn't really an email. It's just await your response. There's a project for you. Oh. I guess we could read that.
No, I don't think we should.
Okay.
Do you want to do? Well, why don't we do just the one Gene in this episode, because then the next episode we'll do the Gene and the Tim Elliott.
Sounds good. Okay, I'll go ahead and get Gene's email. We've got an email here from Gene Hendricks. He's the host of the Hammer Strikes podcast, the Quantum Cast, Anime Freaks, and the brand new Comic Book Fight Club, which is perhaps the filthiest show on the Two True Freaks network. Have either of you guys listened to that?
No, bro. I've just included his trailer in my own show, Hey Kids Comics. Quick plug.
Very good.
And yeah. I haven't had a chance to yet, but I absolutely intend to listen.
They had Hair Metal Hero Unleashed on it, so you can take that.
My God, was that an NC-17 or what?
Yeah, I'm certain in some countries, you know, that will have you executed for playing that show. But Gene writes in with the title of his email, Kira's Mom Jeans. And if that doesn't get you all excited, I don't know what will. He says, Paul, Andy, and Sean. So Paul gets first billing. There you go. This was an interesting character piece for Kira, but it seems like we're going over the same ground that a few other episodes have before. Kira was a rebel, and now she's part of the establishment. Yeah, we know. I like the interactions between Mullabok and Kira, but it's almost like the writers were... Try that again. I like the interactions between Mullabok and Kira, but it's almost like the writers were trying to reinforce the same exact lessons that they have already been learned. But that's really my only complaint with the episode. I do like the Nog and Jake subplot, as it shows that Nog has the lopes for business, even if it isn't all that great in a Federation school. It gives Nog more depth, and he's no longer just the practical joker or repeating rules of acquisition. He proves to Quark and to the viewers that he is a real character with his own strengths and weaknesses. I can overlook Quark's not turning a profit on the Yamak sauce due to his exasperation with Rom for getting it. He's shown that his emotions can overrule his business sense. We also see, as Sean said, a more layered Sisko and how he operates. He does convince I'm dumb this episode, Bashir, to do things officially to keep Kira out of trouble. That's probably why I like Sisko so much. And as Andy said, he's the most Kirk-like of all the next-gen captains. Do we have anything to say about that? You know, that was from Gene Hendricks, and he has a P.S. I never understood the jumpsuit uniform myself. What Kira wears seems to not only be annoying, but put off and take off. But if you're just... I'm trying to read that again. What Kira wears seems not only... not only to be annoying to put on and take off, but you're just asking for a wedgie while wearing it. Ugh.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think her uniform's incredibly impractical. I mean, she looks very good in it, although as my wife pointed out last night when we were watching one of these episodes, she doesn't look like she's allowed to eat when she's wearing that uniform, because it shows off every bulge. But yeah, when you see her take it, what I do find interesting about that, if you watch the scenes where Kira takes her uniform off, you'll see her start to unbutton the top of it, and then she'll either disappear behind somebody or disappear into a room to fully take it off. I think it's two completely different outfits.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like a jacket. You know, you can tell kind of that the uniforms that Starfleet are using is like a purple turtleneck and then sort of zip up, you know, vest or jacket that they wear over it. You know, it's long sleeved, but I know like certain characters like O'Brien will push up the sleeves, you know, to kind of show that he's a working man working on engineering stuff. But yeah, I could probably buy that it's a different uniform. Gene also has a PPS saying the English language pay grade discussion was a reference to my putting one of you, Andy, at that time, as and when I addressed the email. I'll try and read that again. The English language / pay grade discussion was a reference to my putting one of you, Andy at the time, as and when I added, why I addressed the email, which he was happy about, as he meant that he got more money. Oh, okay, we're talking about how Andy got the and moniker behind him. And
yeah, I'm and Anthony Stewart Head as Giles.
So there, you get last billing.
I'm the respected British actor who's slumming this American TV show.
There you go.
We tripled Andy's salary for that episode. Mm-hmm.
I did, yeah. I checked. It came into the bank.
Yeah, that make sure that, well, hopefully, you know, you didn't get any money taken out because of PayPal.
Wait a minute, Andy, it came into the bank?
That was
a mistake.
I checked.
That was a mistake.
Absolutely nothing came in. So
then it's just the right amount.
Yeah.
He finished up saying, Don DeMonzo might have something to say about that, though. Whoa, we don't want to irritate the Don.
No, well, I think his take is 100%, isn't it?
Essentially, yeah. I haven't seen a check, I can tell you that. Okay, well, that's it for email. We've got a couple more emails that we'll read on the next show, but thanks everyone for writing in.
No, you're missing Doris Lang's email, dude.
Oh,
She said Doris Lang has emailed in, Liang, however you pronounce it. She's awaiting our response. There's a project waiting for us. I'm itching to know what that project is.
Well, no, here's the response. Doris, please send us the response. If you obviously you listen to the show, so send us the project, and we'll be happy to get right on it.
Yeah,
we'll. And if it involves paying us money, then we'll get right on that.
Oh, if anyone listening is interested in contacting Doris, you can reach her at dffre443@outlook.com.
Which sounds like a legitimate person to me.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure.
Yeah, she didn't really send us much of the information about the project that we're supposed to do. So I'm thinking about getting back with her.
It's
soon.
By that you mean nothing at all.
Well, I'm thinking in order to get a response from her, it's probably wise if I send her my social security number, date of birth, and address.
Yeah, you get on that, Paul, and let us know how that turns out for you.
Good idea. All right. On that note, let's see what's going to be coming up next time on the show, Andy.
Next time on an all-new episode of Listen to the Prophets, Lionel Luther drops by for some invasive procedures. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.
So long.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Two True Freaks and all of its excellent affiliates are available on iTunes, and you can choose to subscribe to either the entire network if you wish, or pick whichever individual shows you want to follow. We have so many shows to choose from, there's just bound to be one that appeals to your particular fandom. Just search Two True Freaks with an exclamation mark at the end, space, and the number 2.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
Dumbass.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks?
If you've enjoyed our show, please, won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? That helps others find the show, too.
Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
Couple of stone lighter.
The best part of waking up is hearing about Andy's shit.
Well, that's what I was doing.
Well, we appreciate your candor. Thank you.
Was that a planet instead?
Yeah, I think it was. Either that and Flash Gordon, I can't remember.
Something like that. The Planet of Eternal Truth.
Yeah, you know, not that I'm defending photo referencing, because in general, it is a distinctive person that they're photo referencing. But I'm thinking back to, and this may be a controversial one, but Identity Crisis. A lot of the characters that were in that book were references to actual actors. I know Ralph Dibny was they had it
Dick at Van Dyke.
They had it. You know, basically reference.
Oh, blimey, Mary Poppins, they just murdered my wife.
And I think
it sounded natural to me.
And I think it. Of course.
Yeah, David Tennant's American accent sounds natural to me. Yeah, well, it's like in Sins Past, the artist, I think it was Deodato, suddenly started to join Jason Priestley as Peter Parker.
Oh.
And I'm looking at it going.
That book fails on every level.
Yes, every conceivable level. I think I
cover that, or get a group together to cover that on Bins, just because
please
it's such
do.
A.
I would love to hear it.
Well, you may be asked to be on it.
Oh, I would have
then
to
then you can't
read
listen
it again.
I think that little story arc might be worth covering, just because it's so infamous, and I actually haven't heard anybody cover it in depth at all.
No, I forced myself to reread it when we did the death of Gwen Stacy. And it's like, you know what it is? It's exactly like Identity Crisis. It is actually an exceptionally well-written and tense, dramatic story that keeps you on the edge of your seat until you take a step back and go, but this completely messes up everything else.
In my opinion, that story was a massive early morning dump that blocked the bug, and we need to scrub it up.
And I've just cleared it off and flushed it away.
Wow. So do you think that those stories technically would have worked better if they were not necessarily Elseworlds, but sort of out of continuity, if they were just sort of one-off stories, like it was a graphic novel type idea with both Identity Crisis and Sins Past?
I think it would have
been
forgotten.
Really?
Yeah, well, I think if Sins Past had been a what-if, it would have been a very interesting what-if. But yeah, it would have been read and it would have been discussed and we would have gone, well, I'm glad they didn't do this for real, and we'd have just moved on.
But what about Identity Crisis? Do you think that would have worked better? Because I still hold Identity Crisis to be... Go ahead.
I think Identity Crisis had such an effect on the wider DC universe. Sins Past only really affects Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And yet I thought Identity Crisis, although exceptionally dour, I thought that was a good story.
I enjoyed
reading it.
It's exceptionally well written. It's a really good novelistic piece of comic book writing. I just can't help but think that at the end of it, it's completely changed the DC universe and made it a thoroughly quite detestable place.
Mm-hmm. people keeping
not
secrets
just for
from
the
everyone.
Bad guys. It's actually put the characters of like Superman, these icons of light and honor and integrity, and it's cast them in a very dark place. And I don't think that did the overall DC universe any favors.